Reflections on the Revolution in France by Edmund Burke, first published in 1790. This reading is based on a text at the website www.earlymoderntexts.com. Reader, Mill Nicholson. Final one-third of Part 2. What is wrong with the French nobility? The advocates for this revolution, not satisfied with exaggerating the vices of their former government, strike at the fame of their country itself, by painting their nobility and their clergy as objects of horror. If this were only a libel, it would not have mattered much. Your nobility and gentry, who constituted most of your landed men and the whole of your military officers, had they resembled those of Germany at the time when merchant cities had to cooperate against the nobles in defence of their property, had they been like the Orsini and Vitelli in Italy, who used to conduct raids from their fortified dens to rob the trader and traveller, had they been like the Mamelukes in Egypt, or the warrior tribes on the coast of Malabar, one might not want to look too critically at the means of freeing the world from such a pest. The tenderest minds, confused by the dreadful emergency in which morality suspends its own rules in favour of its own principles, might turn aside while fraud and violence were used to destroy a pretended nobility that disgraced human nature while persecuting human beings. The persons who most loathed blood and treason and arbitrary confiscation might remain silent spectators of this civil war between the vices. But did the privileged nobility, who met under the king's command at Versailles in 1789, or their constituents, deserve to be looked on as the Malabar tribes, or Mamelukes of this age, or as the Orsini and Vitelli of earlier times? If I had asked the question then, I would have been taken to be a madman. What have they done since then, that they were to be driven into exile, their persons hunted down, mangled, and tortured, their families dispersed, their houses laid in ashes, and their order abolished, and the memory of it, if possible, extinguished by ordering them to change the very names they were usually known by? Well, read their instructions to their representatives. They breathe the spirit of liberty as warmly as any other order does, and they recommend reformation as strongly. They voluntarily surrendered their privileges relating to contribution, just as the king surrendered all claims to a right of taxation. The absolute monarchy was at an end. It breathed its last without a groan, without struggle, without convulsion. All the struggle and dissension arose afterwards, with the preference for a despotic democracy rather than a government of reciprocal control. There is in Paris a perfectly childish practice of idolizing the memory of your Henry the Fourth. He was indeed a resolute, active, and politic prince, and he had great humanity and mildness. But these never stood in the way of his interests. He never sought to be loved without making himself feared. He used soft language, but determined conduct. He asserted and maintained his authority on the large scale, and distributed his acts of concession only in the details. He spent the income of his prerogative nobly, but took care not to draw on the capital. He never abandoned for a moment any of the claims that he had made under the fundamental laws. He was willing to shed the blood of those who opposed him, often on the battlefield, sometimes on the scaffold. Because he knew how to make his virtues respected by the ungrateful, he has earned the praises of the present revolutionaries, people whom, if they had lived at his time, he would have shut up in the Bastille, and punished along with regicides he hanged after starving Paris into surrendering. If those who praise Henry the Fourth are in earnest in their admiration of him, they must remember that they cannot think more highly of him than he did of the French nobility, whose virtue, honour, courage, patriotism, and loyalty were his constant theme. But the nobility of France are said to have degenerated since those days. This is possible, but I cannot think there is much truth in it. On my best observation, set alongside my best inquiries, I found your nobility to be mostly composed of men of high spirit and of a delicate sense of honour, both with regard to themselves individually and with regard to their whole corps, over whom they kept a censorial eye, beyond what is common in other countries. They were tolerably well-bred, very active in doing their duty, humane and hospitable, in their conversation frank and open, with a good military tone, and reasonably tinctured with literature, particularly of the authors in their own language. I speak of those who were generally met with. Many had claims far above this kind. As to their behaviour to the lower classes, they seemed to me to comport themselves toward them with good nature, and with something nearer to familiarity than is generally practised with us in the contacts between the higher and lower ranks of life. To strike any person, even one in the most abject condition, was unknown, and would be highly disgraceful. Instances of other ill-treatment of the humble part of the community were rare, and as for attacks made on the property or the personal liberty of the commons, I never heard of their doing any such thing. And, while the laws were in force under the former government, such tyranny in subjects would not have been permitted. As for men with landed estates, I had no fault to find with their conduct. I have no reason to believe that in this role the landed nobles of France were worse than the landed gentry of this country, certainly in no way worse than the non-noble landholders of their own nation. In cities, the nobility had no power, in the country, very little. Although the nobility had no considerable part in the oppression of the people, in cases where there was real oppression, they were guilty of considerable faults and errors. A foolish imitation of the worst part of the manners of England has certainly made them worse than they were. Habitual dissoluteness of manners, continued beyond the age at which it can be pardoned, was more common among them than it is with us. They gave too ready an ear to the licentious philosophy that has helped to bring about their ruin. And there was another more fatal error among them. Commoners, who came to be as wealthy as many of the nobility, were not fully admitted to the rank and esteem that wealth brought to the old nobility. The two kinds of aristocracy, the wealthy commoners and the old nobility, were too carefully kept apart, though not as much so as in Germany and some other nations. I regard this separation as one principal cause of the destruction of the old nobility. The military in particular was too exclusively reserved for men of noble family. But this was a mere error of opinion, which a conflicting opinion would have rectified. A permanent assembly in which the commons had their share of power would soon have abolished whatever was too divisive and insulting in these distinctions, and even the faults in the morals of the nobility would probably have been corrected by the greater varieties of occupation and activity that would have arisen from a system of government equally involving the clergy, the nobility, and the common people. All this violent cry against the nobility I take to be a mere work of art. To be honoured, and even privileged by the laws, opinions, and age-old usages of our country, growing out of the prejudice of centuries, has nothing to provoke horror and indignation in any man. Even holding on to those privileges too tenaciously is not absolutely a crime. Every man's strong struggle to keep possession of what belongs to him and distinguishes him is one of the securities against injustice and despotism implanted in our nature. It operates as an instinct to secure property and to preserve communities in a settled state. Nobility is a graceful ornament to the civil order. "All we who are good citizens favour noble birth," said the wise and good Cicero. Indeed, one sign of a liberal and benevolent mind is a slight bias in favour of nobility, an institution created to give a body to opinion and to give permanence to fleeting esteem. Someone who wants to level it is someone who feels no ennobling principle in his own heart. It is a sour, malignant, envious disposition, without taste for virtue or for any representation of it, had seized with joy the undeserved fall of what had long flourished in splendour and in honour. I do not like to see anything destroyed, any void produced in society, any ruin on the face of the land. So I was not disappointed that my inquiries and observations did not present to me any incorrigible vices in the nobility of France, or any abuse that could not be removed by a reform much less drastic than abolition. What is wrong with the French clergy? It was with the same satisfaction that I found the result of my inquiry concerning your clergy to be somewhat similar. It is no soothing news to my ears that great bodies of men are incurably corrupt. I listen sceptically to people who speak evil of those whom they are going to plunder. An enemy is a bad witness, a robber is a worse one. There undoubtedly were vices and abuses in the clergy. That was inevitable. It was an old establishment, and not often revised. But I saw no crimes in the individuals that merited confiscation of their substance, or the cruel insults and degradations, and the unnatural persecution that have been substituted for regulation to make things better. If there had been any just cause for this new religious persecution, the atheistic libellers, who act as trumpeters to animate the populace to plunder, would have trumpeted the vices of today's clergy. This they have not done. They find themselves obliged to rake into the histories of former ages for every instance of oppression and persecution that has been made on behalf of the clergy, in order to justify their own persecutions and cruelties. They invent a sort of pedigree of crimes. To chastise men for the offences of their natural ancestors is not very just, but to take the fiction of ancestry in a corporate succession as reason for punishing men who have no relation to guilty acts, except in names and general descriptions, is a sort of refinement in injustice, belonging to the philosophy of this supposedly enlightened age. The assembly punishes men, of whom many, perhaps most, hate the violent conduct of ecclesiastics in earlier times, as much as their present persecutors can do, and who would express their disapproval of it as loudly and strongly if they weren't well aware of the purposes for which all this declamation is employed. Corporate bodies are immortal for the good of the members, but not for their punishment. Nations themselves are such corporations. It's as though we in England waged endless war on all Frenchmen for the evils that they brought on us in the various periods of our mutual hostilities, or as though you thought yourselves justified in falling upon all Englishmen because of the unparalleled calamities brought on the people of France by the unjust invasions of our Henrys and our Edwards. Indeed, we and you would be justified in this exterminatory war on each other, as much as you are justified in the unprovoked persecution of your present countrymen, because of the conduct of men of the same name in other times. What we can learn from history. We do not draw the moral lessons we could from history. On the contrary, without care, history may be used to harm our minds and destroy our happiness. It unrolls a great volume for our instruction, drawing the materials for future wisdom from the past errors and infirmities of mankind. If it is perverted, it can serve as a warehouse full of offensive and defensive weapons for parties in church and state, supplying the means of keeping alive or reviving dissensions and animosities, and adding fuel to civil fury. History consists, for the greater part, of the miseries brought on the world by pride, ambition, avarice, revenge, lust, sedition, hypocrisy, ungoverned zeal, and all the train of disorderly appetites that shake the public with storms. The usual actors and instruments in great public evils are kings, priests, magistrates, senates, parliaments, national assemblies, judges, and captains. But you would not cure the evil by deciding not to have any more monarchs, ministers of state or of the gospel, interpreters of law, general officers, public counsellors. You might change the names, but the things in some shape must remain. A certain quantum of power must always exist in the community in some hands and under some label. Wise men apply their remedies to vices, not to names, to the causes of evil that are permanent, not to the occasional organs by which they act and the transitory forms they take. If you don't do that, you will be wise historically, a fool in practice. It does not often happen that two ages have the same fashion in their excuses and the same ways of doing harm. While you are discussing fashion, the fashion changes. The very same vice assumes a new body. The spirit transmigrates, and far from losing its energy by the change of its appearance, it gets fresh vigour from its new organs. It walks abroad. It continues its ravages, while you are hanging out the carcass to rot or demolishing the tomb. You are terrifying yourselves with ghosts and apparitions, while your house is the haunt of robbers. That is how it is with all those who, attending only to the shell and husk of history, think they are waging war with intolerance, pride, and cruelty, while under pretext of hating the bad principles of antiquated parties, they are authorizing and feeding the same odious vices in different contemporary factions that may be even worse. After a recent enactment on a stage in Paris of the infamous 1572 massacre of St. Bartholomew, in which the followers of Calvin were slaughtered, an enactment in which the Cardinal of Lorraine is shown ordering general slaughter, the present Archbishop of Paris was forced to abandon his house and to fly from his flock as from ravenous wolves. Thus, a cleric whose function was known to his people only by his prayers and benedictions, and whose wealth was known only by his arms, was forced to flee because in the 16th century the Cardinal of Lorraine was a rebel and a murderer. Such is the effect of the perversion of history by those who have, for the same nefarious purposes, perverted every other branch of learning. But those whose view of history highlights the spirit and moral quality of human actions will say to the teachers of the Palais Royal, "The Cardinal of Lorraine was the murderer of the 16th century. You have the glory of being the murderers in the 18th, and this is the only difference between you." But I hope that history in the 19th century, better understood and better employed, will teach a civilized posterity to abhor the misdeeds of both these barbarous ages. It will teach future priests and magistrates not to retaliate against the theoretical and inactive atheists of future times for the enormities committed by the present practical zealots and furious fanatics of that wretched era. It will teach posterity not to make war on either religion or philosophy for the abuse that the hypocrites of both have made of the two most valuable blessings conferred on us by God. Again, how bad were the French clergy? If any clergy should show themselves to be vicious beyond the fair bounds allowed to human infirmity, they would greatly reduce our indignation against the tyrants who exceed measure and justice in their punishment. I can allow in clergymen, through all their divisions, some tenacity about their own opinion, some overflowing of zeal for its propagation, some bias in favour of their own state and office, some attachment to the interests of their own corps, some tendency to prefer those who absorb their doctrines to those who scorn and deride them. I allow all this, because I am a man who has to deal with men, and must put up with infirmities until they fester into crimes. Undoubtedly, the natural progress of the passions, from frailty to vice, ought to be prevented by a watchful eye and a firm hand. But is it true that the body of your clergy had passed those limits of a just allowance? Your recent publications would lead one to believe that your clergy in France were a sort of monsters, a horrible composition of superstition, ignorance, sloth, fraud, avarice, and tyranny. But is this true? Is it true that their minds have not tended gradually to improve because of the lapse of time, the cessation of conflicting interests, and the sad experience of the evils caused by party rage? Is it true that they were daily renewing invasions on the civil power, troubling the domestic quiet of their country, and making the operations of its government feeble and precarious? Is it true that the clergy of our times have pressed down the laity with an iron hand, and were everywhere lighting the fires of savage persecution? Did they try by every fraud to increase their estates? When not possessed of power, were they filled with the vices of those who envy it? Were they inflamed with a violent, litigious spirit of controversy? These, or some of these, were the vices charged against several of the churchmen of former times, who belonged to the two great parties, Catholics and Protestants, which then divided and distracted Europe. The charges were not wholly without foundation. In some other countries there has visibly been a great lessening, rather than any increase, of these vices. If the same is true in France, today's French clergy ought in common fairness to be praised, encouraged, and supported in their departure from a spirit that disgraced their predecessors, not loaded with the crimes of other men and the odious character of other times. When my affairs took me into France, toward the close of the late reign, so far from finding the complaints and discontents against them that some publications had given me reason to expect, I found little or no public or private uneasiness on their account, except from one set of complainers, not then very numerous, though very active. I found the clergy in general to be persons of moderate minds and decorous manners. I did not know many of the parochial clergy, but in general I received a perfectly good account of their morals and attention to their duties. I had a personal acquaintance with some of the higher clergy, and very good means of information concerning the rest. Almost all of them were persons of noble birth. They resembled others of their own rank, and where there was any difference, it was in their favour. They were more fully educated than the military noblesse, so as not to disgrace their profession by ignorance or lack of fitness for the exercise of their authority. They struck me as liberal and open, with the hearts of gentlemen and men of honour, neither insolent nor servile in their manners and conduct. They seemed to me rather a superior class. Before your revolution, you had about 120 bishops. A few of them were men of eminent sanctity, and charity without limit. I believe the instances of notable depravity may be as rare among them as instances of transcendent goodness. Examples of avarice and of licentiousness can be found, I do not question it, by those who delight in looking for such discoveries. A man as old as I am will not be astonished that several men of every sort do not lead the life of perfect self-denial with regard to wealth or pleasure, that is, wished for by all, expected by some, and demanded with most rigour by those who are the most attentive to their own interests or indulgent to their own passions. I am certain that at the time when I was in France, the number of vicious prelates was not great. Some of them, who were not noteworthy for the regularity of their lives, made some amends for their lack of the severe virtues by their possession of the liberal ones, and had personal qualities that made them useful in the church and state. I am told that in his promotions to the rank of prelate, Louis the 16th had usually been more attentive to character than Louis the 15th, and I believe this may be true, because some spirit of reform prevailed through the whole reign. But the present ruling power has shown a disposition only to plunder the church. No science or erudition can now come from the church in France. Clergymen will now be elected, which will bring licentious, bold, crafty, factious, flattering wretches into their ranks. Abolishing Christianity. In short, sir, it seems to me that this new ecclesiastical establishment is intended only to be temporary and preparatory to the utter abolition of every form of the Christian religion, through a plan to bring its ministers into universal contempt. The philosophical fanatics who guide in these matters have long had such a scheme in mind. Anyone who refuses to believe this must be utterly ignorant of their character and proceedings. These zealots do not scruple to express their opinion that a state can subsist without any religion better than with one, and that they can make up for any good there may be in religion by a project of their own, namely, by a sort of education they have imagined, based on knowledge of the physical wants of men, and emphasizing an enlightened self-interest, which they say will, when properly understood, coincide with the public interest. I regard partisans in England as thoughtless rather than as supporters of this detestable design. I hope they will not succeed in introducing a system of popular election to our bishoprics and parochial curacies. In the present condition of the world, this would be the last corruption of the church, the utter ruin of the clerical character, the most dangerous shock that the state ever received through a misunderstood arrangement of religion. Admittedly, the bishoprics and curacies, under the patronage of the king and the nobility, as they are now in England and were recently in France, are sometimes acquired by unworthy methods. But popular election, much more surely and more generally, encourages all the evil arts of low ambition. Those of you who have robbed the clergy think they will easily reconcile their conduct to all Protestant nations, because the clergy they have plundered, degraded, and given over to mockery and scorn are Roman Catholics. I have no doubt that here and elsewhere some bigots will be found who hate sects and parties different from their own more than they love the substance of religion, and who are more angry with those who differ from them in their particular plans and systems than displeased with those who attack the foundation of our common hope. These men will write and speak on the subject in the manner that is to be expected from their temperament and character. The teachers who reformed our religion in England bore no resemblance to your present reforming doctors in Paris. Perhaps they were rather more under the influence of a party spirit than could be wished, so were their opponents. But they were sincere believers, men of the most fervent and exalted piety, ready to die, as some of them did die, like true heroes in defence of their particular ideas of Christianity, just as they would even more cheerfully have died in defence of Christianity as such. These men would have disavowed with horror the wretches who claimed a fellowship with them simply because they had the same opponents. Two kinds of tolerance. We hear these new teachers continually boasting of their spirit of toleration. There is not much merit in tolerating all opinions, if you don't think highly of any of them. Equal neglect is not impartial kindness. The kind of benevolence that arises from contempt is no true charity. There are in England plenty of men who tolerate in the true spirit of toleration. They think the dogmas of religion are all important, though in different degrees, and that among them there is, as with all things of value, a sound reason for preferring some to others. They favour, therefore, and they tolerate. They tolerate not because they despise opinions, but because they respect justice. They would reverently and affectionately protect all religions, because they love and venerate the great principle on which they all agree, and the great objective to which they are all directed. They begin to see ever more clearly that we have a common cause, as distinct from a common enemy. They will not muddle what is done in favour of Protestantism with acts of hostility are aimed at Christianity. Sacrilege is no part of their doctrine of good works, and so far from calling you into their fellowship on such a basis, your professors will not be admitted to their communion unless they carefully conceal their doctrine of the lawfulness of the condemnation of innocent men, and make restitution of all stolen goods whatsoever. Till then, they are none of ours. Confiscation again. You may suppose that we disapprove of your confiscation of the revenues of bishops and deans and chapters and parochial clergy possessing independent estates arising from land, because we have the same sort of establishment in England, That objection, you will say, cannot hold regarding the confiscation of the goods of monks and nuns and the abolition of their order. It is true that this particular part of your general confiscation does not affect England, but the reason for objecting to it applies here too, and it goes a great way. The Long Parliament confiscated the lands of deans and chapters in England on the basis of the same ideas on which your assembly arranged to sell the lands of the monastic orders. But what is objectionable is the principle of injustice, not the kind of persons on whom it is first exercised. I see being pursued in a country very near us a course of policy that defies justice, the common concern of all mankind. With the National Assembly of France, possession is nothing, law and usage are nothing. I see the National Assembly openly condemning the doctrine of prescription, according to which something's being in effect for long enough eventually creates a right to it. One of the greatest of their own lawyers rightly tells us that prescription is a part of the law of nature. He tells us that the positive settling of its limits and its security from invasion were among the causes for which civil society itself was instituted. If prescription is once shaken, no kind of property is secure once it becomes large enough to tempt those who are poor but powerful. I see the confiscators begin with bishops and chapters and monasteries, but I do not see them end there. I see the princes of the blood, who by the oldest usages of that kingdom held large landed estates, being deprived, with almost no debate, of their possessions, and, in place of their stable independent property, reduced to the hope of some precarious charitable pension at the pleasure of an assembly which will not pay much regard to the rights of pensioners at pleasure when it despises those of legal proprietors. Flushed with the insolence of their first inglorious victories, and pressed by the distresses caused by their greed, disappointed but not discouraged, they have at length ventured completely to subvert all property of all kinds throughout the extent of a great kingdom. They have compelled all men in all transactions of commerce to accept as good and lawful tender the paper money that is a mere symbol of their speculations and a proposed sale of their plunder. The tenant right of a cabbage garden is more ceremoniously treated in our Parliament than you treat the whole body of the moneyed and commercial interest of your country. We have a high opinion of the legislative authority, but we have never dreamed that parliaments had any right to violate property, to overrule prescription, or to force a currency of their own fiction in the place of currency that is real and recognized by the law of nations. What terrifies wisdom most is epidemic fanaticism, because of all enemies, this is the one against which wisdom is the least able to provide any kind of resource. We cannot be ignorant of the spirit of atheistic fanaticism that is inspired by a multitude of writings dispersed with incredible assiduity and expense, and by sermons delivered in all the streets and places of public resort in Paris. These writings and sermons have filled the populace with a savage atrocity of mind, which supersedes in them the common feelings of nature, as well as all sentiments of morality and religion. So much so that these wretches are induced to bear with sullen patience the intolerable distresses brought on them by the violent convulsions and permutations that have been made in property. The spirit of proselytism accompanies the spirit of fanaticism. They have societies to plot and correspond, at home and abroad, for the propagation of their tenets. They have been at work in the Republic of Bern, in Germany, France, and Italy. England is not left out of the comprehensive scheme of their malignant charity. And in England we find there are people who stretch out their arms to them, who recommend their example from more than one pulpit, who publicly correspond with them, applaud them, and hold them up as objects for imitation, who receive from them tokens of confraternity, and standards consecrated in their rites and mysteries, and who suggest to them leagues of perpetual amity at the very time when Parliament, the power to which our constitution exclusively assigns the handling of international relations for this kingdom, may find it expedient to make war on them. It is not the confiscation of our church property from this example in France that I dread, though this would be a considerable evil. My main fear is that it might come to be considered in England as the policy of a state to seek a resource in confiscations of any kind, or that any one kind of citizens should be brought to regard any of the others as their prey. Nations are wading deeper into an ocean of boundless debt. Public debts, which at first were a security to governments by giving many people an interest in public tranquillity, are likely in their excess to become the means of their subversion. If governments provide for these debts by heavy impositions, they perish by becoming odious to the people. If they do not provide for them, they will be undone by the efforts of the most dangerous of all parties. I mean an extensive and discontented moneyed interest that has been injured but not destroyed. The men who compose this interest look for their security first to the government's fidelity, and secondly to its power. If they find the old governments to be effete, worn out, their mainsprings unwound, so as not to have enough vigour for their purposes, they may seek new governments that will have more energy, and the source of this energy will not be the acquisition of resources, but a contempt for justice. Revolutions are favourable to confiscation, and it is impossible to know what obnoxious names the next confiscations will be given. I am sure that the principles predominant in France extend to many kinds of persons in all countries, who think their harmless indolence makes them secure. This kind of innocence in proprietors may be argued by revolutionaries to be uselessness, which may be argued to make them unfit for their estates. Many parts of Europe are in open disorder. In many others, there is a hollow underground murmur. A confused movement is felt that threatens a general earthquake in the political world. Already, confederacies and correspondences of the most extraordinary nature are forming in several countries. In such a state of things, we ought to be on our guard. If there must be changes, we should keep our minds tenacious about justice and careful about property. That will do most to blunt the edge of the damage the changes bring, and to promote whatever good they may do. This may be said. The confiscation in France ought not to alarm other nations. It is not made from wanton rapacity. It is a great measure of national policy, adopted to remove an extensive, inveterate, superstitious mischief. I reply that justice itself is the great standing policy of civil society, and any conspicuous departure from it lies under the suspicion of being no policy at all. When the existing laws encourage men to go into a certain way of life and protect them in it, when they have adjusted all their ideas and habits to it, when the law has made their adherence to its rules a ground of reputation and their departure from them a ground of disgrace, it is unjust for the legislature, by an arbitrary act, to do sudden violence to their minds, forcibly degrade them from their state and condition, and stigmatize with shame and infamy the character and customs that previously had been the measure of their happiness and honour. If to this is added expulsion from their homes and confiscation of all their goods, this despotic sport made of the feelings, consciences, prejudices, and properties of men can't be distinguished from the rankest tyranny. Justice and public benefit. If the injustice of the course pursued in France is clear, the public benefit to be expected from it ought to be at least as clear and at least as important. To a man who acts under the influence of no passion, who has nothing in view in his projects but the public good, a great difference will immediately strike him between what policy would dictate concerning whether such institutions should be set up in the first place, and what policy would dictate concerning whether they should be totally abolished after they have cast their roots wide and deep, so that by long habit things more valuable than themselves are so interwoven with them that the one cannot be destroyed without greatly harming the other. He might be embarrassed, if the case were really such as the logical tricksters represent it. But in this, as in most questions of state, there is a middle. It is not a choice between leaving institutions unreformed and wholly destroying them. I cannot conceive how any man can have brought himself to such a level of presumption as to see his country as a mere carte blanche on which he may scribble whatever he pleases. A man full of warm, speculative benevolence may wish his society otherwise constituted than he finds it. But a good patriot and a true politician always considers how to make the most of the existing materials of his country. A disposition to preserve and an ability to improve, taken together, would be my standard of a statesman. The monastic institutions were a great power for the mechanism of political benevolence. There were avenues with the public direction. There were men, wholly set apart and dedicated to public purposes, without any other than public ties and public principles, with no way of converting the estate of the community into a private fortune, denied to self-interest, and acquisitive only on behalf of some community, to whom personal poverty is honour, and implicit obedience stands in the place of freedom. It is hopeless for a man to try to make such things when he needs them. The winds blow as they wish. These institutions are the products of fanaticism. They are the instruments of wisdom. Wisdom cannot create materials. They are the gifts of nature or of chance. Wisdom's pride is in the use of them. The perennial existence of corporate bodies and of their fortunes are things particularly suited to a man who has long views, who meditates designs that need time to develop, and that are meant to be long-lasting when they are accomplished. A statesman who obtained the command of such a power as existed in the wealth, discipline, and habits of corporations, like the ones you have rashly destroyed, and could not convert that power to the great and lasting benefit of his country, would be a poor specimen. A thousand ways of doing this suggest themselves to anyone who thinks about it. To destroy any power growing wild from the raw productive force of the human mind is comparable with trying to destroy the expansive force of fixed air in nitre, or the power of steam, or electricity, or magnetism. These energies always existed in nature, and they were always detectable. Some of them seemed unserviceable, some noxious, some a mere sport for children, until intellectual ability combined with practical skill tamed their wild nature, subdued them to use, and turned them into powerful and manageable agents for furthering the designs of men. Did 50,000 persons, whose mental and bodily labour you might direct, and so many 100,000 a year of revenue that was neither lazy nor superstitious, appear too big for your abilities to work with? Had you no way of using them other than by converting monks into pensioners? Had you no way of turning the revenue to account except through the improvident resource of a spendthrift sale? If you were as destitute as this of mental funds, the proceeding is on its natural course. Your politicians do not understand their trade, so they sell their tools. You may say, but those institutions are driven by superstition and nourish it by a permanent and standing influence. I do not dispute this, but it ought not to hinder you from deriving from superstition itself any resources it can provide for the public advantage. You derive benefits from many dispositions and many passions of the human mind that are as suspect to the moral eye as superstition itself. It was your business to correct and mitigate everything that was noxious in this passion, as in all the passions. But is superstition the greatest of all possible vices? In its possible excess, I think it becomes a very great evil. But it comes in all degrees and all varieties. Superstition is the religion of feeble minds, and it must be tolerated in them, in some trifling or some fanatical shape or other, for otherwise you will deprive weak minds of a resource that even the strongest find to be necessary. If a prudent man had to choose which errors and excesses of fanaticism he would condemn, and which he would bear, might perhaps think that the superstition that builds is more tolerable than the one that demolishes, that which adorns a country than that which deforms it, that which endows than that which plunders, that which disposes to mistaken beneficence than that which stimulates to real injustice, that which leads a man to refuse himself lawful pleasures than that which snatches from others the scanty subsistence of their self-denial. That, I think, is very nearly the state of the question between the ancient founders of monkish superstition and the superstition of the self-proclaimed philosophers of today. The estates of monasteries. In every prosperous community, something more is produced than goes to the immediate support of the producer. This surplus forms the income of the landowning capitalist. It will be spent by a proprietor who does not labour. But this idleness is itself the spring of labour, this repose the spur to industry. The only concern of the state is that the capital taken in rent from the land should be returned again to the industry it came from, and that its expenditure should do the least possible harm to the morals of those who spend it, and those to whom it is returned. In all the views of receipt, expenditure, and personal employment, a sober legislator would carefully compare the possessor he was recommended to expel with the stranger who was proposed to fill his place. Before the inconveniences are incurred, which must accompany all violent revolutions in property through extensive confiscation, we ought to have good reason to think that the purchasers of the confiscated property will be considerably more laborious, more virtuous, more sober, less disposed to extort an unreasonable proportion of the gains of the labourer, or consume more than is fit, or qualified to dispense the surplus in a more steady and equal way, so as to satisfy the purposes of a politic expenditure, than were the previous owners of the property, whether they are bishops, canons, abbots, monks, or what you please. The monks are lazy, you may say. Be it so. Suppose their only occupation is to sing in the choir. They are as usefully employed as those who neither sing nor say, as usefully even as those who sing on the stage. They are as usefully employed as if they worked from dawn to dark in the innumerable servile, degrading, unseemly, unmanly, and often most unwholesome and pestiferous occupations to which the economic system dooms so many wretches. If it were not generally pernicious to disturb the natural course of things, and to impede in any degree the great wheel of circulation which is turned by the miserable labour of these unhappy people, I would much rather rescue them forcibly from their miserable industry than violently disturb the tranquil repose of monastic quietude. It does not appear to me that the expenses of those whom you are going to expel take a course as directly and as generally leading to harm and degrade and render miserable those through whom they pass, as do the expenses of those favourites whom you are intruding into their houses. Why should the expenditure of a great landed property, which is a dispersion of the surplus product of the soil, appear intolerable to us when it takes its course through the accumulation of vast libraries which are the history of the force and weakness of the human mind, great collections of ancient records, medals, and coins which attest and explain laws and customs, paintings and statues which, by imitating nature, seem to extend the limits of creation, grand monuments of the dead, which continue the regards and connections of life beyond the grave, collections of the specimens of nature that open the avenues to science. If all these objects of expense are better secured from the inconstant sport of personal caprice and personal extravagance by great permanent establishments, are they worse than if the same tastes prevailed in scattered individuals? Does not the sweat of the mason and carpenter flow as pleasantly and as salubriously in the construction and repair of the majestic edifices of religion as in the painted booths and sordid styes of vice and luxury, as honourably and profitably in repairing sacred works that grow hoary with age, as on the momentary receptacles of transient voluptuousness, such as opera houses, brothels, gambling houses, and club houses? Is the surplus product of the olive and the vine worse employed in the frugal sustenance of persons who piously think they are living in the service of God than in pampering the countless people who are degraded by being made useless domestics, subservient to the pride of man? Are the decorations of temples an expenditure less worthy in the eyes of a wise man than ribbons, laces, national cockades, and all the fopperies and follies in which the wealthy waste their affluence? We tolerate these not from love of them, but for fear of worse. We tolerate them because property and liberty, up to a point, require that toleration. But why proscribe the other use of estates, the one that is surely in every way more laudable? Why forcibly carry them, violating property rights and outraging every principle of liberty, from the better to the worse? The Church's Landed Estates. With regard to the estates of bishops and canons and abbots, can any philosophical spoiler demonstrate the evil of having a large portion of landed property passing by inheritance through persons whose entitlement to it is, always in theory and often in fact, a notable degree of piety, morals, and learning, a property which gives to the noblest families renovation and support, and to the lowest the means of dignity and elevation, a property the tenure of which is the performance of some duty, and the character of whose proprietors demands at least an external decorum and gravity of manners, who are to exercise a generous but temperate hospitality, part of whose income they are to consider as a trust for charity, and who, even when they fail in their trust and slide from their character and degenerate into a mere common secular nobleman or gentleman, are in no respect worse than those who may succeed them in their forfeited possessions? Is it better that estates should be held by those who have no duty than by those who have one? By those whose character and destination point to virtues than by those who have no rule and direction in the expenditure of their estates but their own will and appetite? End of part 2.